This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 2nd of May, 2017, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, in leaked comments to a German newspaper, the president of the European Commission claims Theresa May isn't just in a state of denial over Brexit, but in a different galaxy altogether. I'll ask my guests, William Patey and Phil Clark, what they think. Plus Donald Trump's dangerous love of despots, the rebranding of Hamas, and starting today, London's Evening Standard has a new editor. So what's in former Chancellor George Osborne's first issue? Hot off the presses, we'll find out. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to the show, and my guests today are William Patey, an international affairs advisor at Control Risks, and a former British ambassador to Sudan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Afghanistan, and Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, the University of London. Welcome both back to the programme. And we're going to begin with the latest twist in the UK's bumpy exit from the European Union. Last Wednesday, Theresa May sat down for dinner with Jean-Claude Juncker, president of the European Commission. According to leaked comments to a German newspaper, Juncker came away from that meeting in complete disbelief, later telling Angela Merkel that May was in a different galaxy and what will happen after Brexit negotiations. William, is this all... Is it just manoeuvring on both sides, or do you think that he genuinely came away from that surprised at the tone and maybe the preparations?
Well, I think there's an element of posturing. I mean, remember Juncker and Verhofstadt are basically Eurofanatics in the sense that they have a version of Europe that is probably not shared by most Europeans. So there's a bit of posturing. There's a bit of bravado in there. Just accept our red lines, Theresa, and everything will be fine. I mean, every negotiation starts with people setting out their red lines. And, of course, the both sets of red lines are incompatible. So I think this will backfire on them a bit, you know, trying to undermine the Prime Minister just before she goes into an election. I think the rest of the European leaders will probably feel a little bit of sympathy.
I mean, just before we move on for this, just tell me, do you think that it was an attempt to nudge their way into the conversation around the European, the British election? Or do you think it was really more of a European arena that they were looking this in?
I think it's probably European. I don't think Juncker has got the subtlety to try and influence the British election. I think this is he may have thought that I'll send the message that the Prime Minister is delusional, but I think we all think she's going to get a big majority, whatever happens. So I'd be surprised if he thought he was influencing the election. He's trying to influence the negotiations, I think.
Phil, when you look at this meeting and the response afterwards, what's your take on what's being done here to each other?
I think there is a huge amount of posturing going on, but also I'm very concerned by Theresa May's approach to this so far. I think there's a real spirit of a lack of compromise on her part, a real sense of wanting to talk tough, to say we're going to get a good deal for the UK, but without actually telling us what the detail of that would be. And I think Juncker's approach here is to remind her, look, this is a negotiation. At the end of the day, we're all going to have to wriggle a little bit. We're all going to have to compromise a little bit. And by the way, it would be good to know exactly what the UK wants to get out of this precisely. So I think the Europeans are worried about what looks like a real lack of flexibility on Britain's part. And I think Juncker was trying to maybe sort of knock Theresa May back on her heels a little bit.
But what's interesting is, you know, that it does seem like all the European leaders have aligned, and there doesn't seem any squabbling. Do you think this concerns the government as they go into an election, that they may be facing a very unified group of negotiators who are not going to be so easily split as was imagined before.
I think there's absolutely no doubt about that. I think, and rightly so, that should be a real worry for the UK, that not only does the EU seem to have a very united front at the moment, but it's been a long time since the UK has ever had to negotiate a trade deal of any kind. And there are a couple of reports in the European papers today suggesting that at the dinner, Juncker actually pulled out a copy of the recent EU trade deal with Canada, which runs to something like 2,300 pages. And it took 7 years to negotiate that deal. And I think the point he's getting at is that the UK seems desperately ill-prepared for this Brexit deal. And I think that worries the Europeans. It's of strategic use to the Europeans to have Britain so disorganised, but it could also create problems. And I think Europe really wants to send the message that Britain needs to come up with a plan, needs to iron out these details so that this is a much more reasonable negotiation than it looks like shaping at the moment.
I'm not as convinced that the Europeans are quite as organised as they think they are, or we're quite as disorganised. I think it was pretty easy to get 27 countries to agree on sort of broad lines of their red lines. Once the negotiations start, they'll all have different interests. I mean, the German interests in trade, where the Polish interest is in protecting the 600,000 Poles who are here. The Lithuanians, the Latvians and the Estonians will be a bit more worried about the security concerns. How committed will Britain be to their security? There's a whole bunch of stuff. Every European country will have different interests once it gets started. I think the idea that Juncker could come across here and say, well, we've got agree everything that's going to be difficult for you first, and then you'll compromise on all of that, and then we'll talk about the stuff where we'll have to compromise with you. I think the reality is that nothing will be agreed till everything's agreed. You know, that's what we do in international agrements. We will say, yeah, this is how much we will contribute over this period of time, and this is what the rights of EU citizens will be, and we'll just park that, shall we? But we're not agreeing to that until we know what the future arrangements are.
As a side issue, maybe Phil, you could come in here. When we look at the UK election, are you surprised how much there is a real overtone of rerunning the vote almost again for all the parties? They're much more involved in discussing Brexit than I thought they would be. It felt that Labour had said it was a done deal, let's move on. The Tories know where they stand. It's only the Liberal Democrats who have really a question about it. But Brexit seems to come up every single day in the discussions, and many of the other topics that should be headlining don't seem to be getting the cut through in quite the way I'd have thought.
And I think, again, that shows some of the fundamental problems with Labour's campaign here, because I think Labour started this campaign wanting to talk about anything but Brexit. I think they wanted to talk about jobs and the economy and inequality and these sorts of issues. But because Theresa May is dictating the terms of this election very well at the moment, Labour finds itself having to talk relentlessly about Brexit. And the difficulty again for Labour there is that it doesn't actually have a policy that is that fundamentally different from the Tories on this. And so I think we are going to see an election campaign absolutely dominated by this issue. I think the other reason why this kind of interlinkage between the election and the Brexit negotiations is so problematic is that the Prime Minister feels that she has to talk tough. She has to say to her electorate, look, we are going to get a good deal out of these Brexit negotiations. And so I think she's having to portray this very uncompromising stance, which may be useful in terms of winning the election, but is going to make actually negotiating a Brexit deal very, very difficult.
William, it looks like she will win the election, that the opinion polls are giving her huge numbers. But again, when you hear the debate, it feels like the divide that was there at the time of the vote around Brexit is still there in the country. So she was on TV a couple of times over the weekend. Depending on whether you sit in the Remain camp or the Leave camp, it depended how people wrote it up. So either she was like, this kind of battleship cruising through all the kind of commentators, and the likes of Andrew Marr couldn't get a question to stick to her. So well done her. On the other side, the people on the left and people a bit more quizzical about the world of Brexit were saying it was all sound bites, she didn't say anything. And every day it seems that we're still divided as a country. If she just goes ahead all the time just saying it's going to happen, I'm tough, I'm fighting my way through, do you think there's any risk for her in the election that maybe she'll win but she will not carry the country with her?
Well, I don't think she'll carry the country. The country is divided. I'm a Remainer. Just, you may have not thought that from my earlier comment, but I'm definitely a Remainer and I'm not giving up yet. This for me is a Brexit election. I am going to vote I'm going to vote on Brexit grounds, Remainer. I'm going to vote for a Remain MP, and the rest of it doesn't matter because this is the biggest decision we'll make for generations. So we can come back to the NHS, we can come back to schools, we can come back to the taxation. We won't be able to come back to this issue. So I think it's good she's made it an issue. The problem for Labour is, of course, they're trying to defend pro-Brexit seats up in the north and pro-Remain seats up in the south. So I hope it is a Brexit election. I mean, those advocating another referendum, I think that's what we should be talking about.
Just quickly before we move, just for you personally, now many people are going to use their votes to try and vote for a Remain MP, to try and vote against a hard Brexit. Are you doing that as a personal protest or because you think it can have a genuine effect on British politics if lots of people follow your example?
Well, I mean, in my particular constituency, it's possible to vote that way, and it will be in some constituencies it won't be able to have that sort of tactical vote. But where you can, I think if there's a loud voice, if there's a louder voice in the even amongst Labour and amongst Liberal Democrats and Scott Nats, a louder voice against just accepting any deal that comes our way, I think it's a perfectly reasonable proposition to ask for another referendum on the deal.
Well, we're going to move on now. We're going to turn to the United States. It's day 103 of the Trump presidency. And we've now seen more evidence of Trump's apparent admiration of a few dictators and despots. First, it was Putin, then it was Erdogan, and now it's Duterte. The White House has been heavily criticised over extending an invitation to Rodrigo Duterte, the elected strongman of the Philippines. Since Duterte has come to power, human rights organisations have levelled allegations of widespread state-sponsored murders of drug users and drug dealers. So why the love from Washington? Why indeed, Phil?
I think part of this is just pure strategy that Trump realizes at the moment that many of the states he has to do deals with, that he has to negotiate with, happen to be run by these kind of despots. In the case of the Philippines, he feels he has to negotiate with Duterte. He needs the Philippines really as a bulwark against Chinese influence in the South China Sea. So the Philippines suddenly becomes much more important for the U.S. than it's been in a long time. So part of this, I think, is Trump having to respond to the leaders that are put in front of him. But a lot of this, I think, is also personality. That he finds many of these so-called strongmen extremely attractive. In fact, he tries to model himself on them in many ways. If you look at his own style of leadership, he espouses a certain degree of violence, skepticism of an independent judiciary and the free press. He would like to be the likes of El-Sisi in Egypt and Netanyahu in Israel and Duterte in the Philippines. So I think it's a combination of kind of pragmatism but personality as well.
William, should you invite a man like this to come and visit you in Washington? He's even said today that he would very happily meet the North Korean leader and he was sure he's a great guy.
Well, I agree with Phil. There's a high degree of pragmatism here, but it's also consistent with Trump's philosophy. If you put America first, then you're not worried about spreading liberal democratic values, even if he shared liberal democratic values, which is open to question. But you're not interested in spreading it anywhere else. I'm going to deal with these countries and I'm going to see what I can get for America out of that. So there is a bit of consistency there, America first. But as Phil says, he's not a natural he's not a natural Democrat or espouser of human rights. And some of the constraints on his own freedom of action, he's probably looking across to these people and saying, well, I might have some of that.
But doesn't it only work if you get some wins? Because if it turns out that Duterte says, no thanks, I don't want anything to do with you, Duterte has said so many strongly anti-US things, it's unlikely in a way that he may just come around to say, actually, let's forget all that. I'm going to be friends with you again. He seems to want to pull the Philippines out of that US orbit.
Well, if he does, and if he's personally, double-crosses Trump, he'll feel the wrath. I mean, the one thing we've seen is Trump can switch quite quickly from friendship to hostility. So, I suppose he's testing Duterte out. If the Philippines comes into line, that'll be fine. If they don't, I'm sure Trump will turn on just as quickly as he's befriended him.
Now, Phil, I'm going to test your American history here because I want to get your thoughts on Trump's comments that were seen this weekend about the American Civil War. President Trump said, the Civil War, if you think about it, why? People don't ask that question. But why was there a civil war? He also suggested that former President Andrew Jackson, who died years before the Civil War, was concerned about the Civil War and could have prevented it. Historians have said this is a load of old rubbish. Phil, what was he up to? Is he known that he has a lot of sympathy for Andrew Jackson, a populist leader. He's been to his home in Tennessee to lay a wreath. He seems to be slightly enchanted by the man. But this notion that he could have stopped the Civil War, it's a kind of weird version of history that's impossible to get your head around.
Very odd. I mean, Trump apparently has a portrait of Jackson in the Oval Office now. He's known to be enamored of the man. But I guess these comments are particularly bizarre when you look at Trump's own approach to dealing with conflicts around the world in his first 100 days. His comments about Jackson suggest that dialogue and kind of working things out is the way to sort of resolve disputes and conflicts. We've seen Trump, firstly in Syria, and God help us all if he does the same thing in North Korea, to take a very hard line involving an enormous amount of violence and really no attempt at negotiation whatsoever. So again, a lot of people are not only scratching their head about the specific details of why he would think Jackson could have stopped the Civil War, but also scratching their heads trying to work out how on earth this relates to anything that Trump has done in his presidency so far.
Well, finally, in the world of Trump, we mentioned earlier it's day 103 of the Trump administration, but some fear Trump may never leave. In an interview published this week, the Yale historian Timothy Snyder, author of the book On Tyranny, suggests Trump will attempt to expand his power by declaring a state of emergency and taking greater control of the government, but that the plan probably won't work. Is this just hyperventilating, do you think, William?
Well, I think it's important to point out, as he does, that you can't take democracy for granted. There's an assumption that, you know, we're democratic, we'll always be democratic. Well, there have been democratic countries that have stopped being democratic. I'm not quite, I have greater faith in the institutions of the United States and the strength of the separation of powers to say that even if Trump was to try this, and, you know, he makes the point that he's gone after the judiciary, he's gone after the press, and he's beginning to criticize the legislature for not towing the line. So those are the three pillars of the separation of powers that constrain the American president. So he's got some of the instincts, but I'm not sure I'd go as far to say he'll be able to manufacture a crisis that will enable him to have a state of emergency, suspend the Constitution. But we should be vigilant.
Phil, he's suggesting there might be a Reichstag-style fire that then allows him to kind of put in a state of emergency and remain in power. Do you think that's likely again, or do you think that actually Mr. Snyder just has a book to sell?
I think Trump's capable of some version of that. I mean, probably not as well organized and spectacular as the Reichstag, but I think this is a man whose temperament suggests that, you know, if there was need to foment a crisis at home to try and secure his own legitimacy, then he's willing to do it. I mean, I think in many ways the missile attacks in Syria were exactly that, that there was, I think, very little strategic interest on Trump's part in doing that, but this was really about trying to buy him some more electoral support at home. So I think, again, from a personality point of view, he's capable of some spectacular crisis at home if he thinks it sells well to his voting base.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck. Up next, I'll still be with Phil Clark and William Patey, and we're going to be looking at Hamas and George Osborne. Not together. Stay tuned.
How do you take on Donald Trump? In the May issue of Monocle, we head to California, the base of the resistance, to meet the politicians fighting the good fight. We're also in Mongolia for a sit-down with the foreign minister ahead of their elections. We're in Tokyo to take a look inside Uniqlo's new headquarters, Bangkok for its bookstores, Seoul for its fashion, and just south of Melbourne to visit Australia's best-designed hotel. It's our design and property special this month, so we'll bring you a heritage revival in Barcelona, meet some game-changing developers in Warsaw, Oslo and Kuala Lumpur, and we'll tell you which three small but brilliant firms you should commission for your next project. There's lots more, of course, from business to culture, entertaining to fashion, all inside the May issue of Monocle, out on newsstands and on monocle.com now.
Well, welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Phil Clark from SOAS and William Patey, former ambassador, now at Control Risks. We're going to now look at an unlikely rebranding. Hamas, the Palestinian Islamist group, has this week dropped its call for Israel's destruction, though it still backs an armed struggle against the country. William, this seems to be some manoeuvring, perhaps, again, in light of Mr. Trump being in power, the idea that perhaps another round of negotiations could be coming up. What is Hamas up to? Is it trying to make itself look more appealing on the global stage? Or do you think there's been a genuine, not softening of a position, but recognising that Israel is going nowhere? Well, they've been clear today to say that, you know, we're not anti-Semites. We this isn't against Jews. It's against the state of Israel.
I think, I mean, Hamas has been working on this document for some years now, and part of it was to become more respectable. And they've obviously been under pressure to adhere to the Quartet principle so that they could be recognised in government. But so this move is coming at a time, I think it's a particularly opportune time for them, as the prospect of a Trump administration trying to move into this field. You've got an ageing Palestinian leadership, and there might be a Palestinian leadership election, and Hamas would want to be part of that whole process. So there are a number of things coming together. They've certainly suffered from their charter, original charter, which was unashamedly anti-Semitic and very extreme. They've softened it a bit. You know, it's only a little bit. They have distanced themselves from the Muslim Brotherhood and the wider extremist organisations. I think they want to fall on the right side of the line. There's a sort of division going on in the Middle East between Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and possibly the Muslim Brotherhood on one side and other forces on the other. I think Hamas are trying to position themselves on the side of the reasonable forces. We're a national liberation movement. We're not part of this great jihadist front. Therefore, you have nothing, you outside Israel have nothing to fear from us. So it's part of a rebranding, I think, and repositioning themselves to be part of any future negotiations, even though they don't look likely.
Phil, you know, Jared Kushner said that, you know, he wants to be involved in Middle East peace, and he believes, you know, that there is the potential for an agreement. You know, we've seen Trump's unorthodox version of diplomacy. Who knows, perhaps it would have a little bit more cut through here, because he would, it seems, speak to anybody who's willing to speak to him. I mean, in Hamas, it's an interesting example because, you know, terror has changed so much over the years. They almost look like an old-fashioned terror organisation. There is somebody to speak to and pick up a phone to, and they have a list of demands, even if you don't agree with them. So whether you regard them as freedom fighters or terrorists, they sit there with somebody you can negotiate with. Do you think that makes them look a little bit more appealing at this time, oddly?
Possibly. And also, it's not insignificant that Abbas is going to Washington in 2 days' time. That's also the sort of thing that the other groups you mentioned don't tend to get to do, to sit down with the US president to actually talk about a Middle East peace process. So I think that shows that Hamas is still an absolutely central player in all of this and is afforded some legitimacy but by the US and other powers. So I think that's part of this push for respectability as well, a recognition that they do have these opportunities to negotiate at a very high level. They certainly don't want to lose that. I mean, I think William's comment too about the fact that the new charter doesn't mention the Muslim Brotherhood is extremely significant, because again, that shows the role of Egypt in the kind of regional picture, that Egypt had been making noises about breaking off its relationship with Hamas and making the transport of food and other supplies from Egypt to Palestine much more difficult. Clearly, one of the stipulations from El-Sisi's government has been that any links with the Muslim Brotherhood be completely broken. And so we're seeing that in Hamas's charter as well. So I think the Egypt dimension here is extremely important.
And William, when you look at the IRA, when you look at what's happening with FARC, you get a sense not only did people negotiate their way to peace in the end because they feel they can get a victory, there tends to be a bit of weariness as well. And I just wonder, you know, if you're the Palestinians and you've been, you know, fighting this fight for so long, you've got nowhere. Do you think there is a feeling in some of the older leadership that maybe negotiations or maybe being a bit more, having a little bit more flexibility wouldn't be such a bad thing?
Well, I think, you know, some of the older leadership, Abbas in particular, would say they've been pretty flexible. I think there's a weariness and a fear amongst Palestinians that the Israelis are not really interested in a two-state solution and that might be disappointing. disappearing every day that there are more settlements in the West Bank. And when the Knesset then legalises settlements that everybody in the international community thinks are illegal, there could be an idea of becoming more current that two-state solution is dead and they want to have a one-state solution. So that would make life very difficult for Israel, because that state would be very difficult to be Jewish without a high degree of apartheid.
We're going to leave the last part of the show to a newspaper review. So we normally have the headlines at the top of the show. We're going to do them at the bottom, because London's Evening Standard, which is the piece of newsprint that gets shoved in your hand for free as you leave the office, it's got a new editor, and that's George Osborne, who used to be the Chancellor of the Exchequer here in the UK. And he takes over at a very interesting time. And this is his first outing as editor today. William, can you sniff any of Mr. Osborne's skills as a journalist here?
Well, I have to give a bit of a health warning, because when you look at a paper through the eyes of George Osborne as the editor, certain things come out. And it does look like he's been handed an easy one on the front, an attack on May by Brussels. That's something he would have loved to have had. And his manifesto is in the editorial, is basically soft Brexit. So if you think that George Osborne took the editorship of the Evening Standard and attempt to continue the battle with Theresa May, the first issue lives up to it with the reintroduction of the cartoon with Theresa. And I think we're almost at the end of the programme, and for the first time I'm going to use the phrase strong and stable, which you would certainly not get through a Theresa May interview in half an hour. But there's quite a few George Osborne hallmarks in this version.
Well, you can always tell who the editor is by the op-eds and by the paper's leading comment piece. And it says this is a paper committed to freedom and optimism, engaged in the world. And it talks about this remaining London's paper and how it kind of, it's not keen on what's happening with Brexit, and it's going to test everybody, be globally minded. This is where you see George Osborne, isn't it, Phil?
No, absolutely. And I think we're going to see a degree of schadenfreude and a sort of desire for revenge on Osborne's part now that he's got Theresa May in his crosshairs. So this could get very entertaining through the election campaign and onwards through the Brexit negotiations. I mean, I never thought I would say that about a newspaper edited by George Osborne, but I think that is the case. I think the other issue, of course, that this throws up is not just Osborne, but the kind of tendency of so many MPs to have these little side projects, often quite lucrative little side projects. Osborne's at least had the decency to say that he'll stop being an MP. He's not going to run at the next election. But so many MPs at the moment seem to be only representing the public as a kind of part-time job. In Osborne's case, he also had this very lucrative consultancy with BlackRock worth something like £650,000 a year. I think this raises some big questions about exactly how public service-minded some of our elected representatives are.
But the good thing is he's got a great Rolodex. And I've been on newspapers, I worked in newspapers before, where we had editors who were slightly on the celebrity scale, but they had contacts. So they may not have been able to kind of do a good headline, but they knew who to phone. And that's surely, William, especially in the run-up to the election, that's something he's going to be able to deliver.
But some of his contacts in the next government may not be returning his calls. I think that may be his problem. Well, he may have their numbers, but he may have to change his phone number.
Just a couple of things before we wrap. So the page 2 and 3 is about the Met Gala in New York. I don't think you wrote this headline either. Rear guard action, which is a thing about, I think, women with nice derrières in nice frocks.
Yeah, it's a bit reminiscent of The Sun, I thought, that one.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. And I'm not sure there was a kind of a message on the front page where it says, I knocked out a legend, now I'll take out the rest. I've got a feeling, I don't think he knocked out a legend, he was slightly knocked out, but anyway, that's the story of Anthony Joshua, the boxer, not Mr. Osborne going after Mrs. May. Anyway, that's all we have for on today's show. I'd like to thank William Patey and Phil Clark for joining me. And today's episode, well, it was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Acosta Pacheco and by Hunter Charlton. And our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. There's more music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's our dedicated design show, Section D, with Mr. Joshua Fennett. We'll have more on news and analysis on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. But for me, Andrew Tuck, just time to say goodbye.